Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies. Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies. And our guest today is someone we've known a long time and that we've been meaning to have here for an official guest appearance.
Official guest appearance.
That's right. Andreas Deja is a master animator. I don't know how else to describe what he is and what he represents, but he has spent decades at the Walt Disney Studio bringing to life characters that we all know and recognize, and
keeping history alive in a really beautiful way. And that, for anybody who knows us, they know that that is very important, and you do such a beautiful job with it, Andreas. You really do. I think you bridge. For a lot of people, you're able to sort of bring the history forward. And that makes it, for folks who are not necessarily a fan of history, it makes it current. It makes it interesting. And for those of us who already love it, don't have to prove a damn thing. It just makes us appreciate you more.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. And this whole thing about diving into Disney history, or animation history for that matter, happened to me by accident, because I was really interested in meeting the people who made these movies that I loved so much, the Nine Old Men and other people. So I did have a chance to meet them because, as you might remember, I started at Disney in 1980 and they were still around town. They were all here. So I sought them out and invited them for dinner and asked them like a million questions. And the interesting thing about them was, once they found out that you were serious about what you wanted to know and what you wanted to achieve, they gave you all the time in the world. So I had this amazing resource and the luck, really, to be here at the right time when I could still talk to these people. And then that, in these conversations, I just found their past very interesting, to find out about their triumphs but also struggles, because that's what made them human. That was very important to me, because as an outsider, you think, this is like the most beautiful Santa's workshop, there ever is. These were humans, they had their frustrations and their ups and downs. So it was really interesting for me to find out about that. And then it went beyond. I was talking to people from Warner Brothers and other studios, and working with Richard Williams, who also, of course, has a huge knowledge of history. The whole thing became really interesting to me. And I still learn and I still research through my blog and otherwise.
Well, we should plug, before we go any further, the fact that you have curated an exhibit at the Walt Disney Family Museum in San Francisco dedicated to the film that turned your life around, I guess you could say, The Jungle Book. Tell us about it.
Well, I just happen to have the catalog right here.
now how convenient.
Now available at the museum shop. They got some advanced copies that they're starting to sell. It was really a life changer.
You just held up, because we're an audio show, you've just held up a majestic looking coffee table book on The Jungle Book.
Yeah, if you go to the Disney Museum shop online, you can actually purchase it right now. They have it available. So yeah, but going back, what you said, Leonard, it really did change my life in a profound way. I don't know. I mean, when I think back, if I had seen as my first Disney film, which was Jungle Book, but had it been 101 Dalmatians, had it been Cinderella, my path would probably be the same, because I would have been equally impressed and excited. But it just happened to be The Jungle Book. And I was about 10 years old when I saw it, and my head started spinning. I just literally couldn't believe what I saw. I had only seen, in terms of Disney animation, clips on our black and white television, and even that intrigued me. And but seeing this whole Technicolor spectacle for an hour and a half, or you know, was just it was overwhelming. And I needed to know, you know, of course I knew who did this, Walt Disney Studios, and I knew that they were in Los Angeles, but I still had questions.
Of course.
If I wanted to work there sometime, which seems naive and childlike or even childish, but there was this urge to find out, you know, and make contact with the studio. So my English wasn't very good. It was actually non-existent at 10. And so with the help of my English teacher at school, or our English teacher, I put a letter together with a few questions, basically asking, how can I prepare myself here in Germany, where I grew up, to sometime work for you guys? Do you recommend certain schools or programs, or can you give me any tips? And wouldn't you know that they did write back, and I still have that letter from way back. And it was a form letter, but it did answer all of my questions. Apparently, lots of kids did write in those days with those kinds of questions. And the most important advice that they gave me was, I remember the very phrase, sentence, it said, if you are serious about the kind of animation that we do here at Disney, when you apply, please don't show us any copies of Donald Duck and Pluto, because we can teach you that here at the studio later. They said, you need to become an artist on your own right first. So just draw everything, draw your brothers and sisters, draw your pets, go to the zoo, draw the animals often and see what they look like, but also study how they move. And when you're a little bit older, you need to do life drawing because you need to know the human figure. So all that was new to me, because I didn't know you needed to know the human figure to become a good animator. I thought you draw cartoons, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I actually had to think about that for a while. And I remember there was a re-release of Bambi coming through town. And I saw, and I watched Bambi, of course, massively impressed again. And I remember Bambi trying to get up and wobbling across the street, the screen, doing his first steps. And it kind of dawned on me, wait a minute, whoever drew this and animated this had to know where the rib cage is,
yep,
and how the head connects to the body, where the knees are and the heels, and had to know all this stuff at any given frame and then work with it. So then it made complete sense to me. And then I just went for it and went to all the local zoos and drew the animals for years and started life drawing. I think I was 14, and my parents thought that it was a little early for me to draw nude people.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, but also my parents really don't come from any artistic background. So I remember my first life drawing evening, I came back and showed the drawings, my first life drawings. And my dad said, so when you were there in class, did you have photographs or did you draw from pictures? And I said, no, we had actually a model who took their clothes off. And I mean, he was almost in shock. And then I said, why don't you call my art teacher at school? And because he knows a little bit about this. So he did. And my art teacher said, well, Andreas is a bit more advanced than others in drawing. So he's at the right age where he should start this. So he reassured my parents, there's nothing strange going on there.
That's incredible. Incredible.
It's a straight line. It's a through line.
Yeah.
From you seeing Jungle Book, being inspired, acting on that inspiration right away, contacting the Disney studio, they tell you have to become an artist. And so we set about becoming an artist.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really was kind of straightforward. And people who talk to me are so astonished at my path. And the only thing I can say, well, it was pretty simple. What I had, which maybe distinguished me from other kids who at one point want to do the same thing, I had a lot of passion. It was, it really was the most, it became the most important thing in my life.
Yeah.
And I remember even talking to my art teacher at high school, because he said, oh boy, if you want to get into a field like animation, you know, there'll be competition, and this thing has to be the most important thing in your life. And at that time, I got scared, and because I, those are big, big words.
Of course.
And, but in thinking back now, it really was the most important thing in my life. This is what I wanted. Always thinking like, it's so crazy, you know, leaving your family and your country and going to America to draw cartoons for Walt Disney. It probably won't happen because everybody tells you so. My sister told me, and my parents and my friends. This is like a crazy dream. And but you always think to yourself, try anyway, just in case, try. You know, it can hurt trying.
But that, I mean, I remember, because I was very young when I first met you, I remember watching videos of you drawing Scar and drawing Jafar and looking into a mirror, which is obviously, it's a shot that they have of a lot of animators now, where they look in the mirror, they make a face, and you see them drawing it. But that was my first image of you, was raising your eyebrow and sort of looking like that. And so in my head, whenever I looked at Scar or Jafar specifically, I saw you in the best way. I saw you. And so then when we got to go to your house, which is, especially the upstairs, a love letter to all things animation. I mean, it really was like walking into some kind of wonderland. You surrounded yourself with so many beautiful things that it's inspiring, you know?
Well, it keeps inspiring me. And people ask me who come to my house, now you're an artist, how come you don't have your own work on the walls? And I'm just answering by saying, what good will that do? You know, I did that. I need to look at things that I can't do or can't do yet, or that inspire me to do better and to do maybe something differently in the future. That's what I need to look at. So I have hardly anything of my own on my walls, because it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Talk a little bit more about your first encounters with the Nine Old Men. We should explain that the Nine Old Men was a sobriquet given to veteran Disney animators who, and that name
the
was
people who made everything you love.
The name was a joking reference to Franklin D. Roosevelt having packed the Supreme Court during his presidency, and so the relevance of it is long gone, but the name stuck. And these guys were people who sort of invented character
animation.
Not just
sort of. They were, everything you have now is because of them. You know, it's really that simple. And each one was a character. That's part of what makes them, like, they are. I've always thought of it as the seven dwarves, the nine old men. That's in my head how I visualize them. It's true, you know, because each one is a character, and each one, you know, I just, as I say, if you look them up, get a visual, it'll all come together, because it's like they weren't even real. Almost they were these fantastic creations. And again, they're the reasons that you have everything you have in animation now.
But that's what was so fascinating to me, again, you know, in meeting them, to really, I mean, just what you were saying, to find out that they are very different from each other. I mean, you go and spend an afternoon with Ward Kimball, and that's a very different experience than going to Ollie Johnson House and spending time with him. Or I flew up to San Francisco and spent an afternoon with Milt Collin, and that's a different experience. And also what was unique and slightly unsettling was the fact that they would judge each other and have opinions, and even though they respected each other, but there are little things like I would see Frank and Ollie and I wouldn't even ask, and they would bring up the subject of Milt Kahl and just say it, that Milt Kahl was an animator who was thinking about drawing, making drawings move, and he just didn't internalize the personality as we did. And I didn't even ask. But they would. It was something that was on their mind, and that they had thought about a lot. And I would go and see Milt Kahl, and he would talk about his colleagues. He would say, well, yeah, Frank and Ollie, they're good animators, but they can't draw worth you know what, you know.
But that, but that's they really were like a family, and each one it's love, even when they're angry with each other or they're annoyed. But part of that is because they were together so much, and they had a lot of weight on their shoulders in terms of what was expected of them, because they were the heavy hitters.
But they had these interesting rivalries, like a lot had to do with casting.
Sure.
Might have heard this, that Milt Kahl and Mark Davis were often cast the difficult human characters, and they did them really well. And there was a reason why Walt cast them on that. But they wanted to do the Captain Hooks, and right. they wanted to do the villains, you know, and they didn't, you know. And then they blamed Frank and Ollie, would go up to the directors before the movie starts or production starts and say, how about we're doing these characters and the Mark and Milt can do the others. And there was that going on. But on the whole, just like you said, Jesse, they really were a family, and they definitely respected each other. Milt Kahl told me once, he said, I have high regards for Ward Kimball. I could never work like him. He said the thing that Kimball did with the cat in Cinderella, with the teacups, you know, on the train, when Lucifer is trying to find the mouse. He said, I could never do something like that. That is so Kimball and so Chaplin, that was not his mindset. So even though as I don't want to say arrogant, but as proud as Milt Kahl was of his talent. And he would say things like, I am the best draftsman around here. That's no bragging. That's a fact. You know? So he knew how good he was, but he also knew his limitations. So he knew when other people could do better.
Yeah.
To explain for some of the folks who may not be into animation as deeply as we are displaying right now, when Walt Disney got ready to make a feature like Peter Pan, he had to decide who would be the principal animator of every major character in the film. And so it wasn't so much that you gave an animator a scene as you gave an animator a character to work with. And they were going to act out that character. So when we watch Peter Pan, where Frank Thomas was assigned Captain Hook, does that mean that he drew every scene in which Captain Hook appears?
Frank would draw the most important personality scenes that show you who the character is and the character's motivation. So the top acting scenes would be done by Frank Thomas, and then he would supervise other animators who would do maybe assignments like action or fights, things like that. So there would be a small group of animators following Frank up, but he would have to supervise and make sure that the character feels the same, even though various people work on the same character, but that the approach to the animation, the movement, and the acting is the same.
Several years ago, you did an event at the Academy for Bambi, and it was... I didn't know if I'd be able to sit through Bambi because it upsets me so much, because I'm a big old sap. And first of all, getting to see it on a big screen and getting to see it on a big screen as an adult was overwhelming because it is stunning. Having seen it as a kid, I didn't remember just how absolutely gorgeous it is. And it really is. But you had this scene that you explained before the film showed, of exactly what you were talking about before, where, you know, the animator has to know all of the parts, all of the anatomy of the animal, because it's when Thumper and Bambi are on the ice and Thumper's trying to show Bambi how to ice skate. And it was, first of all, you were so happy, and that was, you were so excited. And I loved every minute of that, because you were as giddy as everybody in the audience watching was. But when you talked in detail about these pieces and to look at it and see that even just the hand-drawn part, well, Desai, I can explain. Talk about what you did.
Well, I was lucky because for that night, the Disney studio or the archives, the Animation Research Library actually, had put together what we call a pencil test. So it's a whole sequence. The studio's in the habit, or has been in the habit, of keeping all the animation ever drawn. No other animation studio has that kind of an archive, but Disney does. So they went back and and got all the scenes that were drawn for the sequence in Bambi where Bambi and Thumper play on the ice. And to show the, you know, the contrast that, of course, Thumper is a very good skater and Bambi is not. But they actually refilmed each drawing, lined it up. So we had the pencil version. There was no color, no background. You could just see the pure animator's art, pencils on paper, you know, pencil drawings, just doing things and emoting already without color, without all that stuff. And I think that it was just a reminder to the audience that, golly, these things really are drawn, because they are drawings, you know, pencil drawings.
One frame at a time. Film passes through a camera and then a projector, 24 frames a second. And every one of those frames has to be drawn. When you look at the statistical side of animation, it's just overwhelming.
I don't math, but if I did math, it would be a lot. But
you, in addition to being an astute and eloquent historian, you are also, of course, an animator yourself. How do you approach the enormity of the task at hand? Do you just say it's one hour at a time, one drawing at a time? What is your philosophy about that?
It is interesting how little people know on the outside what an animator goes through and how we do what we do. I give you one example. Even though we have these making of featurettes, you know, as bonus material on those DVDs, and which gives you a little bit of insight into our process, but people on the whole really don't know. I was working on Lilo and Stitch in Florida, animating Lilo, and there was a party that I was invited to, and there was one lady who was not familiar with the process, and she was introduced to me, and she said, "Oh, you're an animator Disney, huh?" He says, "Oh gosh, I feel kind of sorry for you, because you have to make all these drawings over and over, and they all look just about the same. And I don't even know how you guys do this, and it must be so boring." And I took a deep breath and I thought, "Lady, let me educate you. There's nothing boring about bringing something to life." And I explained to her that these drawings are not the same. Each one is different. Also, I don't do every drawing that you see on the screen. I do only the ones that really matter, that have to be there, the framework of the scene. Then I have an assistant who does the so-called in-between drawings. Yeah. So I explained the whole process to her, and her eyes just got wide open. And, she saw me as this prisoner, this drawing prisoner, came to his desk and has to crank out a certain amount of drawings every day that all look alike. And so hopefully she got the idea. But my approach is really, I'm trying each time to take to heart what Ollie Johnston, one of the Nine Old Men, told us younger animators in the early 80s during a lecture. He said, "You guys coming into the business, you know, you need to learn one thing, that you shouldn't be thinking about animating drawings. You should animate feelings." Mm. That sort of sounds a little abstract at first, because I thought, well, of course you animate drawings, you draw and you make the move and hopefully something will come across to an audience. But he was talking about his philosophy that the feeling and the emotion comes first. You need to be sold on that. You need to feel it yourself. You need to understand the character's feelings. And then that will guide you how to animate that and where the arm is and what kind of head tilt you might use, you know. But don't think about that first. Just think about, you know, the inner feelings of the character. And that was their approach, and I tried that also to be my approach. And because when I started at the studio, it really was the opposite. I drew better than most people at the studio in 1980, because I had a pretty good art training. I didn't have any specific animation classes during the 1970s. We didn't have those. But since the studio told me in their letter, you know, you have to learn how to draw, that was very important to me. And I knew, of course, Disney's drawing standard where they were. It always seemed to be way up high and I was way down there. So you try your best to learn and learn more about anatomy and improve. So again, when I was starting there, during my first year, I was doing character designs for the infamous Black Cauldron, because they hadn't had any doing those way back. So drawing comes fairly easy to me. But then when it came to animation, I remember one of my first scenes was with the character of Dolben, who's sort of a mentor to the main character, Taran, this pig keeper. And I was like medium close up, and I did the drawings, and they looked good. And I put them under the video camera in those days and shot them. And then I pushed playback, and those nice drawings just didn't do the right thing. It didn't feel like the character was feeling anything important, or it didn't feel like the feelings were clear, you know. But in those days, we had the benefit of having Eric Larson, another member of the Nine Old Men. He was still at the studio each day, and he was helping us. Mm. He was not only part of the animation training program for new people to come in and do a mentorship, which I had done, but even on when we were assigned to a movie, we could always go to Eric and say, "Eric, I there's something wrong here. I don't know what it is." And repeatedly, I remember Eric's question to me would be, "Well, what are you trying to say here? What are you trying to convey?" So I would tell him that, and then he would take my pack of drawings, and he would say, "Okay, if that's what it is," and then he would look through the drawings. "You do need that drawing." And then he would flip through, and "You don't need that drawing. You would throw that out." Hmm. "And you don't need this drawing, but you do need this one." And then he would maybe make two or three rough doodles himself and create like another set of drawings, a mix of drawings thrown out, my original drawings and his drawings. And then I would take that again to the video camera and film that. And every single time it was like, oh, night and day. There was something coming through. There was clarity in the way the character moved, you know. And so we had Eric to help us in those early days, thank God.
What's the first feature that you worked on when you were at Disney?
Well, the first one was the Black Cauldron. They were in the process of finishing The Fox and the Hound. And I remember management telling me, they said, "Andreas, we don't need you on that. We're almost done. But we have this new feature called The Black Cauldron, based on a series of books by Lloyd Alexander. And we don't have any character designs yet. And we like your portfolio. You seem to draw very Disney. So you have the Disney style already sort of adapted." And they said, "Why don't we put you together with another young artist who just graduated from the California Institute of the Arts, or CalArts. He has a very different way of drawing. He draws a little not crazy, but stylized and eccentric. And why don't we put the two of you in one office, and maybe you guys can come up with something new, different, mixing my style with his style." And that person was Tim Burton.
Sorry.
Before he became Tim Burton, to us, he was just Tim, you know, one of
the guys. Right, right.
And so I spent my first year with Tim in one office, and we were exchanging drawings back and forth. And I tried to, because we all liked what Tim was doing in his eccentric way. And as soon as I tried to Disneyfy those drawings and make them solid and add the anatomy, it lost whatever he had in it. It lost his style. So in the end, it didn't really work out. And Tim got frustrated because of that and moved on. He stayed with the company and got into stop motion. He did a stop motion film called Vincent, and then moved into live action and other things. But I stayed on and did animate on the Black Cauldron, did a lot of bad scenes. But by the end of that movie, I kind of felt like, okay, I've done a lot of mediocre stuff now. I've done a lot of bad things. But I got those things out of the way. I was like ready to do better now on the next movie. And I was really lucky that after a short stint on The Great Mouse Detective, I was just briefly on that, I was lucky enough to work on Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Mm. And that also changed my life, because it meant like working with another passionate person like Richard Williams and rubbing, you know, elbows with him and getting his take on animation. And of course, if you remember that movie, that was based on Hollywood animation from the 1930s and 40s. So very loose, very what we call squashy and stretchy. And to dive into that world was then enabled me to really loosen up and get my stiffness out of my work. And it really helped me with future assignment too, whether it was Gaston or Jafar or the others. But it was a great experience, this whole Roger Rabbit project.
Well, I want to go back half a turn, because as much as I revere animation, as much as I've watched it and studied it, and as many times as I've interviewed and met animators, it took me a long, long time to recognize the fact that being a good animator doesn't necessarily mean you draw well. That some of the best animators aren't, as you say, good draftsmen, as Milt Call used to brag about himself. I met Mark Davis, the man who animated Cruella de Vil in 101 Dalmatians way back when, and naively asked if he would draw her for me. And his drawing is very crude, because that's not what he did. Mm-hmm. He didn't draw, he animated. And there's a world of difference.
Yeah, it's not an illustration or doing a drawing for a fan. Like you said, it's one thing, but when you animate, you think about a sequence of drawings. One drawing is nothing. One drawing doesn't move. And even with two drawings, you might have two extreme, but that just doesn't really represent life yet. It starts to become interesting after three drawings, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 12, 50 drawings. Then you have a series that you combine that with the element of time, because each drawing is only being seen for a 24th of 1 second. And that's when it becomes magical. And to me, it's still the ultimate magic trick. I remember talking to Richard Williams about this. How is this even possible? I mean, what a gift of physics or whatever you want to call it, that this is even possible, that you can take a sheet of paper and do another one, do one drawing after the other. And the audience buys it. It also has to do how your eye works. You know, that your eye, when you're being shown so many drawings in 1 second or in 1 minute, it forgets, or it doesn't register each drawing. It only sees motion.
Yeah.
And that's just a wonderful magic trick, I think.
Well, that's when you showed Thumper and Bambi playing on the ice. And Thumper, I mean, it's not hard to love Thumper. It's great face and wonderful expressions and joyful. But to watch it in pencil and for it to have the same impact as when it switches into full color, it's because it is alive, and you don't need the rest of it for it to be great. That's why little flip book, something as simple as a flip book can make you laugh. You know, it can be a stick figure, but if what they're doing is funny or if what they're doing is clever, it makes you laugh. You know, it is all about the intent and importantly, the emotion that comes across.
Yeah, I recall when I was still living in Germany and was in high school, I had a Super 8 camera, and the Super 8 camera actually would allow me to take frame by frame stills. So mm-hmm. It didn't only film running scenes or motion, but also I could do frame by frame. So I remember I had these two tennis rackets with some lights attached to it, built my own little setup at home, and I should have kept it simple in pencil form just to test it out. But I only knew animation in color in those days. So I actually bought some cells, and I had this zoo setting, and there was a zookeeper who was feeding fish to some seals. But I started out with a camel, and the camel was walking. And I had inked these drawings with a Sharpie onto the cells, and I painted it. And I only got as far as 1 second of film. So I sent it off, and even though it was wobbly and crude, but something, the camera was moving for 1 second, you know. And again, it reinforced the whole thing in me that this is something you want to pursue. You want to do more of this. This is so incredible.
I had a tiny taste too with my best friend's father's 8mm standard 8mm camera. It did not have a one frame, adjustment. We had to sort of push it like pricking a pin, you know, into a balloon, and then hope that it just took the one or two frames that you wanted. And then, yes, watching that move and that crude little thing that we did together, it was exciting.
Yeah.
It was exciting.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you, if you look at, this is a loaded question, because I think I know what you're going to say. If you look at, we'll say Captain Hook again. If you look at a drawing from Peter Pan, can you tell if Frank Thomas drew it or not?
I can, because I've done some research. And as you probably know, the studio not only kept all of the drawings and the artwork from each film, but they also keep so-called drafts. And that's like a typewritten booklet that lists all the scenes in order, and it tells you how long the scene is and who animated it. So I had access to those drafts, and I could really find out who did this great scene or who animated that part, and then where the animator switched, and then where the character feels maybe a little bit different. So I do know that. But it was actually, in the end, it was very clear to me that there were different drawing styles. I could see this in Jungle Book. Even as a kid, I saw that Mowgli changes a little bit, at least facially. That sometimes his facial composition, it was a little different than in other scenes. So I knew various artists had to work on that.
Well, that's the ultimate magic trick. You take a group, some cases a very large group, of artists, individual artists, and you ask them to draw the same character.
Yeah.
as closely hewing to the model as possible. How does that even happen? And I can't imagine how it happens, but it does.
Carefully, slowly.
Yes.
Well, and there are disagreements sometimes. I remember talking to Eric Larson about Sword in the Stone, and I told him, you know, how I love certain sequences in that film, and they really touch me, and they're really funny, and all Eric could think of is how skinny that boy was, and how he had to animate a whole bunch of scenes, and he said, oh boy, that boy was so hard to draw. He was so skinny. So there are some animators who had a hard time with stylized designs, and the boy is kind of stylized. He's just skin and bones, basically. But there were other artists and animators, again, Mark Davis and Milt Kahl, who always pushed for designs that had some sophistication and that were different and were influenced by fine art, maybe. But then you had also the Frank and Ollies in that group who had a hard time following. They did their best, but they also then got help from Mark Davis on Milt Kahl. They would go over scenes that Frank and Ollie had done to make sure that there is as much character consistency as possible. So yeah, the whole thing in the end is a team effort. You know, you have to sometimes leave your ego in your pocket and think about the thing as a whole.
Well, especially as you became one of the senior animators, you know, when you go from being, you're starting out and you're doing, you know, whatever it is you're asked of, and then now you're in the place where you can say, I will draw these and then you can do the rest. You know, you're now in the place where you're the person people come to for advice, and you're the person that people are so excited to meet. You know, you're that next generation of it.
Yeah, it was always interesting. I think my status changed at Disney when I came back from Roger Rabbit. Mm-hmm. And I had done that, and it was a success. And the studio knew that I had played an important part in it on some other levels as well, not just the animation part. But we had mostly a European crew. And so we had animators from Spain and from Italy and France and Germany and all that. And I remember there was a little bit of a culture clash when studio management would come in and give from the US, they would come over and give the crew a pep talk. And they would say, like, you guys are just the greatest in the world. There's nobody who does this kind of work. And they were all thinking, well, how would that make the guys in Burbank feel?
Mm.
You know, it was just a over the top pep talk. So they didn't really understand it. And so I came in whenever there was like a little misunderstanding like that, I came in and explained that this is how American management talks sometimes.
Yep.
But the main thing is that they really like our work. Sometimes they praise over the top, you know, and there were other times when an animator might get chewed out for having not done a scene right and wanted to quit. So I would go in and say, look, they didn't mean it that way. You know, they really need, so I would function as the culture mediator between European and
American
sensibilities, a little bit like that. So the studio knew that, and I think I've proven myself to be a pretty good animator and team member. So then by the time we were casting the Little Mermaid, which was next, I got my own character, which was King Triton, and then other characters that really I had to supervise, animate and supervise with a group of people. And so, yeah, it was all after Roger Rabbit. I think my stock had risen slightly.
Yeah. And people don't, many people don't know or never learned that Who Framed Roger Rabbit was not a Walt Disney studio picture.
Right.
It was made by Steven Spielberg's Amblin Productions and the so-called adult division of Disney, Touchstone Pictures, which had just been birthed, actually.
Done been birthed.
And as soon as it was a hit, Disney took credit for it.
Yeah.
but before it came out, they were very wary of being associated with something as rude and adult oriented as that film. But success breeds success.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now you are not unique, but you are one of the individuals.
No. You are unique.
Well, you are unique.
You are unique.
Because you're Andrea Stasia. And there's only one of you, like Tigger.
Tigger.
but you withstood the pressure to put down your pencil and pick up a stylus and work with a computer screen. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a turbulent time period for me anyway, because the signs were all there that Disney would switch to computer animation only. I mean, for a while, they did both. They had Pixar doing the CG films, you know, starting with Toy Story, and we were still doing our 2D films. But then I think what happened, looking back, is that some of our best story people from the 2D end of the company went up and helped Pixar and helped their stories. And our stories maybe took a little bit of a dip and weren't as great anymore as The Lion King or as Aladdin. And the box office reflected that. And the studio read into those numbers that the audience really prefers CG now. So they went that way. And from a business point of view, I completely understand that.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, and management encouraged me to pick up CG animation and give it a try, which I did with the help of a tutor and who actually came to my house. I wanted it to be really comfortable. And at that time, the going software was called Maya. And we installed that in my computer. And I did the famous bouncing ball, just a really simple test of where you show like a ball just bouncing and reacting to a hard surface. And then we did a character jumping over something. And then I turned to my tutor and I said, you know what? I don't think we need to continue because I know now how this works. I know what the procedures are. But I said, the one thing that I would really miss doing this is I can't be spontaneous. There's nothing spontaneous in the process of computer animating. it's highly calculated. Math has a lot to do with it, which is my weakness. And I said, I the reason why I like drawing is because you have these happy accidents. Your pencil or your hand all of a sudden does something else that wasn't planned, that gets you another way of doing things. And I can't get that, doing it the CG way. So I parted ways with the company, and I finished my assignment of Tigger in the Winnie the Pooh feature. And then we parted ways very friendly. They understood me, I understood them.
Yeah, of course.
And, but I really felt like deep inside that I still had to express myself through drawing, through hand-drawn animation, and that's what I'm still doing.
And you're doing it on your own. So mm-hmm. Talk about your labor of love project, Mushka.
Yeah. So after doing a variety of things, after my 30 years at Disney, I taught at USC for a term. I taught character animation. Then I did a commercial, an animated ad, and I saw what that world was like. But then in the end, I thought what I really need is something that I can get my teeth into, like a sizable project. And then I asked myself a series of questions. It was very logical when I think about it. I asked myself, what do I like to draw most? Well, probably animals. So what kind of animals would you like to animate that you haven't that would be really fun? Well, a tiger would be really great because I have some experience with big cats from Lion King. I can refine that with a tiger and maybe hopefully take it to the next level. But then how about in terms of story, I add a girl because you have a young, innocent girl with a ferocious or potentially ferocious, dangerous animal. And that combination could be interesting. Maybe she raises a tiger and from a cub to adulthood. And that's how those two bond. But maybe, and again, me just freewheeling, thinking story points, not so much as a complete story, but just story ideas. Maybe as the tiger grows, becomes a big animal, the girl senses some danger from some bad people around them who want to kill the tiger and sell him for money because a dead tiger is worth a lot of money. And so the only thing she can think of in order to save him is take him back deep into the forest where she found him. And hopefully he will learn to be a wild tiger away from humans. But maybe things don't go according to plan. But that's all I had. And that's not a story yet. So what do? You reach out for help and ask people if they can help you flesh this out, this basic, very basic root idea. And so I talked to a friend who's a very freewheeling artist. He does architecture and songwriting and has always worked for himself, never worked for a company. So he has no formulas of doing things. Mm. I said, you are the guy, you can help me with this. And so he turned this into a novel. And I read the outline, and all of a sudden there was the grandmother. We're starting out as with a girl living with her grandmother in Kyiv in Ukraine, or the former Soviet Union. This was all set in the 1970s. And then the grandmother falls ill on New Year's Eve, and the girl is sent to Eastern Russia, to Siberia, to be with her father for a while until her grandmother recovers. But she's never met her father. He didn't raise her. So then there was this strange father figure. And so I had all these unique character relationships. Well, now I was just thinking about the tiger and the girl. Now I had a real world around the girl and the tiger. And that really, it felt like a novel then. And I think the movie feels now like a film novel. And at first I thought, well, there aren't a lot of gags in here. It's not super funny. There's no sidekicks. But then I thought, well, that's okay. I think the story, the way it is, holds its interest. And why not do one like that? You know, why stick to sidekicks and the I Want song and all of those things that are staples of a lot of features? And so now I'm at a point. Actually, I'm holding the pencil, as you can see right here. I'm literally on my last 20 drawings for the movie. And it's going to be a 25-minute film. And I already have Skywalker Sound working on the sound effects, and we're recording in October an orchestra in Vienna. We're doing it from here, but they turn out to be the best for this project. So all the post-production is already happening.
You also had someone, you had someone fairly important write a song for you, of our mutual friends, and we are very lucky to share the mutual friends we have. The name that folks won't know, Howard Green, he is like the godfather of all things and probably one of the best humans you'll ever meet. I think he posted, and Fabrizio, our friend, posted one Mr. Richard Sherman playing a song.
That's right. And this all started about 10 years ago when I had just gotten the first draft, the first outline from my film, from my writer friend. So I knew where the story would be going. And I had lunch with Richard, and he asked me what I was doing right now. And I said, well, Richard, I think I'm going to do my own movie. What's the movie about? So luckily at that time, I told it particularly well. I don't always do. You know, when you have to tell a story, you go sideways, or you forget something. But for some reason, I told it particularly well. And Richard got all excited, and he was completely with me. And then by the end, his fingers were tapping at the edge of the table. And he said, oh, he says, I think somebody at this table here could maybe write a song for this film. And my head just turned sideways. And I said, Richard, you're kidding, aren't you? And he says, no, I think there could be a lullaby here. And since the whole piece is set in Russia, I have some Russian background. And not only that, his family told me this later, that he wrote that lullaby, which is the most beautiful thing. He wrote it that night.
Of course he did.
It just came to him, you know.
Of course
he did. That is now the musical centerpiece of the film, and the score even takes cues from that lullaby. We hear that theme, that Mushka theme throughout. And so, but I mean, think about that. For me, coming in full circle, I grew up with Richard's Jungle Book.
Of course.
Robert Sherman's Jungle Book songs. I mean, that was my childhood, you know. And then all these decades later, having him contribute to my film, my personal film, is just as crazy as it gets, and wonderful, of course.
It's when I saw it, because I know how long you've been working on this. It's a long time, and when that video popped up, I thought, well, this must mean that we're getting there. This must mean that it's really happening, because if we're sharing this incredible song, then there might be a light there at the end where it's all going to come together for you, which is so exciting.
What is the song called?
Yeah. It's just called Mushka's Lullaby.
Okay.
I'll play it.
And we're actually using it twice in the film. There's a montage sequence in the middle of the film where we see the girl and the cub, and by the end of that montage sequence, it's the girl and the grown tiger. Mm. So it's basically how she raises him and in various situations. So we having the singer actually just hum the tune with some music, and then we have the final song and lyrics over the end credits.
I'm so happy for you. I'm so happy that it's all coming together. You know, as you say, it's on the one hand, I'm so glad that you left Disney in a positive way. There'd be no reason not to, you know, for it to be anything but positive. But it's a difficult thing when you've been somewhere for so long and it's been your home base. To branch out on your own is a lot. Even though you know all the people you know and you've been doing this for a long time, it's still a big thing to do. And
it did give me a chance to do this.
Of course.
All these years, you know, I mean, you just can't help it. There are always some ideas back in your mind. Well, maybe I can do on weekends, do my own short film, something little and personal. But in the end, it always turns out it takes more than just a weekend here and there.
Yes.
You have to commit and put in the hours to do something like this. So because of the situation, the way it evolved, I now have a film that otherwise wouldn't exist.
Yeah. No, again, and part of why you need that time is because you care so deeply about what you do. It's not as simple as turning it off and on. So it's not like, oh, I'll work on this during the week and then somehow I'll still have energy to work on something else, devoting yourself completely.
Yeah.
There's only one of you, unfortunately, and you can only, you know, spread yourself so thin.
But luckily, I got some help, you know, because obviously I can't do all the aspects of the filmmaking.
Of course.
I have a former background painter, Natalie, who painted backgrounds on Lion King and Aladdin, and she ended up painting about 80-90% of all the backgrounds. And, you know,
wow.
And luckily, she had a real passion for the film, because I had her come over and look at my story reel, which is the whole movie with no animation in it, just still drawings. And by the end of the film, she was just in tears, and her makeup was running down her eyes. And so she got involved, and I said, Natalie, you are the right person for this. I need your talent and I need your passion for this. And she stuck with me all those years and painted these absolutely amazing backgrounds and set the mood, you know. And so I had help from some people. I could never find my dream team. I thought I would find so-and-so, so-and-so, and hire so-and-so. But all my friends, they were all busy, or most of them, with their own projects.
Of course, or
other assignments. So the team stayed very, very small. And that's the reason why it took so long. And I ended up animating probably 80% of the film myself.
Wow.
Oh, my.
So a good chunk. So whatever is not working animation-wise, I'm pretty much...
It's you.
It's on me.
Man, you are all we should add, because D23 is coming up. You are a Disney legend. And while we don't necessarily love all the people that they've made legends of late, simply because they're not actually Disney people, it doesn't matter. I love that you don't get me started. It gets bad. I love that you're a Disney legend. And this year, two greats, Don Hahn and Chris Montan, are becoming Disney legends. And I'm very excited for both of them. Because Don,
they're good people.
They're good people, and they love this. They love what they do. And if you don't know either of these names, we've had Don on the show before. I was thinking we have to get Chris. Look them up, because again, these are the people that have shaped so much of what you love and have grown up with. Animation is a massive undertaking, whether it's computer or not. It's massive, and that's why when you watch the credits and all of those names are going by, and I always love the part where they tell you how many babies have been born.
Yeah,
because it's been years. I always remind people, all of those names, I know it can look like a lot, but that's a human. Every single name is an actual human. That's how many people it took to create something. It's kind of overwhelming, really, when you think about it.
But the fun of it is working within a team. And this is something that I actually enjoyed doing very early on, because you find out sort of gradually that, okay, it's not always your way. You might have to compromise once in a while, but you can benefit from another person's idea. I'll just give you one random example. One of the last films I worked on was The Princess and the Frog.
Mm-hmm.
I animated the character of Mama Odie and her snake Juju.
So good.
And I remember at one point Mama Odie is using her snake as a walking stick. And of course she can't see.
Yep.
And accidentally the head of the snake gets banged against like a bell on this boat that she's on. And so I needed a close up where, in typical cartoon fashion, the head of the snake just goes, blah, 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 you know,
yeah.
Typical shape. And for the world of me, that day I couldn't make any funny drawings like that. I just couldn't do it that afternoon. And I'm going like, wait a minute, next door is Eric Goldberg, Mr. Funny. I'm going to go and check if he can help me. He gave me a couple of drawings and I was off and running. So that's the beauty of teamwork. When you get yourself into a hole, you can get help. You have all these people, and you know, and ask people who you respect and they will help you. And I would do the same thing, because my draftsmanship was better than some of the other guys, you know, and they would come to me and say, look, this hand looks weird. And I would say, well, how about this? You know, but that's the beauty of teamwork.
Yes.
But we did have applicants over the years that came in, had a great portfolio, could animate well, but they weren't used to working that way, you know, because they always made their own decisions. And again, once in a while you have to compromise, but it's all good. In the end, it's all good.
So, the year 2023, which looms ahead
unbelievably,
will be the year of Mushka. Yes.
Well, we're actually finishing in the year of the tiger, which is this year. The Chinese tiger is this year. So we are finishing this year. And then the plan is we're working hard to meet the deadline for the Berlin Film Festival in sure. February. I thought that would be appropriate because I was raised there and people in Germany know me. They know my path to Disney and all of that. So I think we can do it because by the end of the year, we're going to have that final file of the finished movie.
Well, good for you. Good for you.
And
it, I think fate steps in and sees you through. Is that what the line from the song, When You Wish Upon a Star? So fate will see you through. I have confidence in that.
I think there's something to that. Yeah. I've just been really lucky, to have all these experiences to again, meet people who meeting your idols, you know, and making even friends with them. And, it was beyond my wildest dreams. And then opening up or curating an exhibition for the Walt Disney Family Museum. You know, I told this in my opening remarks when we opened the show recently. I said, if you had told me this, that all this would happen, if you had told me this as a 10, 11-year-old, I for sure would have had a childhood heart attack.
Right.
These things to a kid in Germany just don't happen.
No.
Yet they have. They have. So it's like a dream.
Look, when we got to see you recently with Richard Sherman on the Disney lot, and I told Richard was one of the first people I told that I was pregnant last year, and we sat there and he held my hand and we talked about all of the things. And then when she was born, I got to introduce them in person, and that meant so much. But just recently, when we were all on the lot, and that was her first time being on the Disney lot, a lot that I've grown up on with all of you, for us to be standing there and Richard is playing with my baby and you're there and Howard's there and our other friends, and it was just like I watched this video and I cry because I think she has no idea yet how lucky she is. Because I was so lucky to grow up with all of you. And it made my childhood that much more incredible. And I think now I hope she understands that she's going to have the same kind of thing. And to be raised around you guys, you're so passionate. You care so deeply about what you do. And you want to make things for the world. You want to make things that are beautiful. And that's just so special. And I feel so lucky, as I say, that I had that and that she's, you know, she's getting that same experience.
And you are continuing a grand tradition,
yeah,
Andreas. And animation posterity will certainly thank you.
Yeah.
But I think audiences will thank you right away.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for saying that. That means a lot. And I still need to point out that probably my first exposure to Disney history were your early books. There was an international bookstore in Cologne and they had your hardcover of the Disney films.
Oh my.
Where for the first time I could look up the credits that were in print and how useful that was to me to find out, you know, who was involved and who wasn't involved in certain films. So that was my first exposure to Disney history. So thank you for that.
Wow.
They say full circle.
Yep.
Full circle.
Matt. Well, now that we've finished complimenting each other.
Yeah, right.
And beefing up each other's egos.
Yeah.
We will say thank you, Andreas, for your time today and continued success on the completion of your labor of love.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
All right. Hopefully we'll see you soon, Andreas. You take care.
See you soon, both of you. Thank Bye-bye. You.
I think you met him when The Little Mermaid was
something like that.
Was just coming out, something like that.
I don't even.
Long, long time ago.
As I say, and if you look Andreas up, look at his face. I swear, when you see his expressions, you will see Scar and you will see Jafar. The eyebrows specifically. You really, really will. No, look, I was so lucky. You guys gave me. You've given me one hell of a life, and I've gotten to meet so many phenomenal people, and Andreas is one of them.
Yeah.
And he really is, you know, exactly as he talks about that because he had, because he was the way he was approaching these greats, they gave him time. Now he does the same thing.
Right.
He passes it on. And that is so important, because there's only going to be, you know, as time goes on, there are only so many connections, real connections, where you knew someone firsthand.
Yeah.
So he is a part of keeping the nine old men and some, you know, those other Disney greats alive. He's a part of that. And he knows how important it is.
Yeah.
You know, he understands.
And he upholds their standards.
He really does. He really, really does. No, God, I really do. I will never forget the first time we went to his house and seeing his studio upstairs. And I was just going, this is amazing. Dad, why do you have so many books? Can we live here? It was, yeah.
You should check out his blog. You could check out videos,
all the
YouTube,
things.
Any chance you have to hear him, talk.
Oh my God.
About animation,
his
classic
presentations
animation, are outstanding.
Beautiful.
So,
man, oh man, less beautiful is social media, but it's where we are. You are at Leonard Maltin. I am at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. You're also on Facebook. You can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
That's true. We're also on Patreon.
The Maltreon.
Patreon.com/Maltin on Movies is where you go if you are inspired to help support what we do.
Yeah, we really appreciate it.
And we appreciate every dollar that you send. And we have ways of thanking you, too. You can find all that at patreon.com/Maltin on Movies. And you'll find us here again next week. Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.